Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theatre, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/yesmen2013.
DJs play
45 RPM records
all day.
Tune into KBOO on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records,
while from noon to 8 p.m. we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue with refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th
in person at KBOO from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight
to celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45RPM2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland announces a newly discovered budget surplus of $14 million.
A bill outlawing LGBT workplace discrimination passes in the U.S. Senate.
And a new report reveals that the CIA has been paying AT&T to voluntarily supply metadata of its customers' phone calls.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 7th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. New information released yesterday by the City Budget Office shows that the City of Portland has even more of a budget surplus this year than announced last month. The new $14 million is in addition to an $11 million surplus recently announced by the Budget Office. For more, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Dennis Thoreau with the Portland Mercury.
Can you talk about what you found out this week about the City of Portland's budget surplus for this fiscal year?
We found out that there is a $14.1 million pot of money that was left over. Some of that was because of spending controls in the fiscal year that ended in June. And some of that is because, about $3 million of that is because bureaus decided not to carry over funding requests from 1 year to the next. So we ended up with a $14.1 million surplus. And keep in mind, this is coming after a budget year when we cut $21.5 million, and at one point thought we'd have to cut $25 million. So it's causing some folks maybe to feel like there's a bit of whiplash, but that's kind of the way things are right now.
Well, and I know people are probably happy to find out that there's more money in the city budget, but also it doesn't necessarily breed confidence in the city budget office or in the mayor's office that they couldn't see this coming.
Well, the budget office is pretty good at deducing trends, and they were pretty upfront last year that, again, it wasn't the economy that was affecting that spending gap, that it was a lot of policy decisions. But, you know, they make recommendations and they still answer to the political side of the equation. And so and it's the mayor who prepares the budget. It's the mayor who still retains the power to dismiss the city budget director, though all of council has some authority in getting information now. That was a change that happened this year for the first time. We used to not even have access to the information that we've been able to obtain under previous administrations going back for decades. This is a pretty new thing, thanks to Commissioner Amanda Fritz and some others on the council. I think going forward, you know, the mayor's office is going to have to maybe exert some kind of control. Some control or will on this, and the thing that's troublesome for I think some of the folks who are looking at cuts is they're calling for a stabilization budget next year. They see this money and they want to make sure it's real, and they don't want to sort of open the floodgates and let people make spending requests yet.
And where is this surplus money going to end up?
So some of it is going to be used to pay down debts. The city has a 911 system. It has some lingering debts on City Hall when they rebuilt it several years ago and did some restoration work. They're hoping to use some of that money to pay the debts off early, and that would have the effect of creating more money, actually, in the budget going forward that they can spend. Instead of spending the surplus, should be spent probably on programs that aren't ongoing. You don't want to hire people and then lay them off after you've spent the money once. So they're using it. They're trying to convert it into money they can use to rehire workers, spend on longer-term social services programs. And so that's going to be a chunk of the money. Some of it's there's going to be a sop to the business community. They are going to raise the deduction for business license taxes, and that's something that the business community has really wanted. That's going to cost some money. They're going to have to pay for a streetcar extension possibly through 4th and Montgomery, because it could be that the mayor is looking to reconsider urban renewal around Portland State, which was going to pay for that previously. And there is $1.7 million for homelessness programs that hopefully is a ramp up to some more ongoing spending on social services, which, you know, we've seen the harsher side of that conversation for much of the summer and fall. And finally, next week, we might see some of the money that actually addresses the causes that put people on the streets.
So next week is the budget adjustment. When and where is that, and what can we expect there?
That's at City Hall on Wednesday. Probably council meetings usually start at 9:30. I'm not sure if they've scheduled exactly when that'll happen during the day, but we can expect to see the mayor's plan for what he wants to do. The budget office has made its recommendations. The mayor then puts his forward, and then the council discusses and deliberates. I think you'll see a fairly broad agreement on a lot of those pieces. The streetcar track piece, that could be the most divisive one. There are other options for purchasing and putting that work through. But the homelessness money is a gimme. There was a lot of strong support for that in a lead-up vote a couple weeks ago. And I think we'll see the debt payments happen, too, because the benefit of having more money in future budgets just makes sense.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Theroat. He is a reporter with the Portland Mercury. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Oregon Department of Transportation has begun to move boulders to block off a third underpass near I-205 that had served as a refuge for homeless campers. In a similar action last month, the Oregon DOT faced criticism from homeless groups after a homeless man died just 4 days after he was displaced from his shelter by the DOT. The decision to move the rocks to block off any possibility of lying down or resting under the highway overpass stemmed from requests from the Lentz Neighborhood Association. The chair of the association, Nick Christensen, complained that he had grown weary of seeing random couches and bookcases near the overpass, but he did not comment about the actual people who were displaced or the fact that one person had died after losing his shelter, his sleeping bag, and his dog during the DOT sweep.
On October 29th, a 100-year-old, 2-foot-wide water main burst along West Burnside Street in downtown Portland, flooding parts of the street and adjacent basements. As a result, stretches of West Burnside and Southwest 4th Avenue were closed for 5 days so workers could replace dirt under the pavement that had degraded into unstable mud. Many small local businesses along the route suffered hardship, both from water damage and from losses incurred while the street was closed to traffic. One such business is the Blue Collar Baking Company. But local organizers have collaborated with Union SEIU 503 to put together an event that may help the bakery. Today, community organizer Abigail Carroll joined me to discuss details of the upcoming cash mob.
First of all, can you tell me what you know about how the Blue Collar Bakery was affected by the recent water main break on West Burnside Street?
Yeah, absolutely. So in speaking with the owner, Warren Becker, we found out that he had a pretty significant loss of supplies and revenue. He lost about a month's worth of supplies, and because his business was closed for a couple of days, that was some really important revenue that he lost.
Have any efforts been made by the city to compensate any of the businesses along that road for losses sustained during the water main break?
You know, I have not heard a thing about any actions by the city. And my hope is just as a community, we can come together to support this great small local business.
In that vein, could you just give a few details about the cash mob that you have helped organize in collaboration with SEIU 503?
Absolutely. The idea actually came out from a fellow young SEIU member, Jonathan Spagel, who had heard about how the Blue Collar Banking Company had been affected by the water main break, and we started talking about what we might be able to do. And so we came up with the idea of a cash mob, and really a cash mob is just a group of people coming together to give a local small business kind of a burst of revenue. And it's a simple concept, but just like labor unions, it's amazing what people can accomplish and what good can be done when people come together and for a cause. And so our hope is just to be able to get a lot of folks out and showing their support for this business.
Have you ever been involved with organizing this type of action before, or has the union? And if so, what levels of success have those had?
Well, my organizing has mostly been just as a young, active union member, and so around contract campaigns and things like that. This is actually my first community event, so we're excited to see the turnout. But we have a lot of great community partners, other labor unions who are there to support us, and so hopefully we're going to have a great turnout and really do some good for this business.
Well, just to close, can you give a little information about the details in terms of when this is being planned for?
Yeah, the cash mob at Blue Collar Banking Company is happening this Saturday, November 9th at 10 a.m. They're located at 319 Southwest Pine.
I've been speaking with Abigail Carroll, who is a community organizer who's taken part in putting together this event. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
Yesterday morning, the Canadian timber company Interfor began logging part of the Jazz timber sale in the Mount Hood National Forest using a large Feller Buncher logging machine. This comes despite the fact that the logging season ended on October 31st. Interfor was apparently given a waiver to log by the Forest Service in two units of the Jazz sale called Bass and Drum. The reason given for the waiver was dry weather. The environmental organization BARC, which has an ongoing lawsuit challenging the Jazz sale due to the geological fragility of the area and poor environmental assessment by the Forest Service, was able to obtain a temporary restraining order against Interfor by midday yesterday. For more on the story, Air Cascadia host Chris Andre spoke with Meredith Cox of BARC this morning.
On Tuesday afternoon, we got word that logging could start on the Jazz timber sale in the Mount Hood National Forest as soon as Wednesday, yesterday morning. And we were shocked to learn that because the logging season officially ends on October 31st. So what this meant was that the Forest Service had granted a special exemption to the Canadian-based logging company Interfor to log the 2,000-acre timber sale. We got BART ground truthers out into the field early yesterday morning who found that one unit of Jazz had already been logged, despite the extremely wet soil and conditions that we are concerned will mean runoff and erosion into the watersheds of that region. The Jazz timber sale is 2,000 acres spread across 30 square miles of the Kalawash River watershed, and the Kalawash is considered one of the most geologically unstable watersheds in all of the forest. The Kalawash is sort of in the area of Bagby Hot Springs. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with that area. So that's the area that we're talking about, but it is home to threatened salmon, and it is considered a very unstable place known for landslides and soil erosion. So we had filed a lawsuit against the Forest Service last July questioning the legality of the Jazz timber sale. And so we were shocked when the Forest Service made this special exemption for out-of-season logging. It seems to us that they are essentially willing to let the trees of this timber sale fall before our case can even go before a judge. And to add insult to injury, really, this 2,000-acre timber sale is being called a restoration project. So we're questioning how the Forest Service can call this timber sale restoration, yet allow special out-of-season logging in this wet weather. We could see out the window today, it's pouring rain. It's not a good time to log if you are concerned about water and soil quality. And yesterday, we did file for a temporary restraining order to halt logging on this timber sale. And we're calling on an emergency rally for this afternoon because the most expedient way to stop logging would be to have the Forest Service pull the special exemption and not issue any more special exemptions for logging so that our case can go before a judge.
Who basically signed off on this? Who is responsible for granting this variance?
Well, the Forest Service has a new... The Mount Hood National Forest has a new forest supervisor named Lisa Northrup, and she has ultimate say over this sort of decision. So if you go to our website, again, there's information on a phone number to make a phone call to Lisa Northrup and ask that she not grant and stop this special exemption and not grant any further.
The rally occurred this afternoon. BARC's website can be found at bark-out.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Tracy Prescott McGregor, a resident of Clatskanie, Oregon, who is trying to stop a coal export terminal expansion that will change her rural farm home into a major port terminal, after this newscast. That's followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6, featuring culture, music, wisdom, and more from Native American elders. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and a high near 52 degrees. Tomorrow night will remain mostly cloudy with lows dropping to around 44 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 52. In Beaverton, it's 38 CPM with a high of 52. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM with a high of 53. Powell Butte measures at 25 CPM with a high of 42. Seaside, Oregon has 33 CPM with a high of 52. Hanford, Washington has 29 CPM with a high of 47. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 36 counts per minute with spikes up to 51 CPM. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's nigh on to 5:18 p.m. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's always inspiring to see global corporate giants crush small farmers, stomp on nature, circumvent our laws by hook or crook, and deceive and gouge consumers. Welcome once again to the phantasmagoric world of DNA manipulators. In particular, this branch of genetic engineering wizardry calls itself, quote, synthetic biology. Yes, that's an oxymoron, meaning fake life. But it's also moronic in this case, for it's a crude and costly attempt by high-tech alchemists at such corporate powers as BASF and Cargill to genetically modify microorganisms to produce something wholly unnecessary, artificial flavorings and fragrances. One of their, quote, achievements is to use a powerful form of gene-altering technology to re-engineer yeast and make synthetic vanilla. Hello, of all the world's needs, why put so much money and scientific energy into something that's on every grocery shelf, both in a natural and artificial form? Also, this corporate wizardry creates a massive threat to the livelihoods of thousands of small tropical farmers in developing nations. Madagascar, for example, one of the world's poorest countries, has 80,000 farmers whose only reliable cash crop is vanilla beans. I really count on that to make a living, says one. Well, sniff the faraway synthetic makers, we can do it cheaper. But can do is not the same as will do. Even though the lab-made vanilla is not as good as nature's own, corporations will use their political and marketing muscle to capture the market and jack up prices. Advertising gimmickry is already in play, for the industry claims that its fake stuff is a natural product. Therefore, it need not be labeled as a GMO, even though it is. This is Jim Hightower saying, to get a bigger whiff of this outrage, go to Friends of the Earth at foe.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A new report shows that the telephone company AT&T gets paid by the U.S. government for metadata that they harvest from customers' telephone calls. $10 million United States dollars were doled out to the company for voluntarily supplying phone call information. The CIA did not subpoena the company for the data. They simply gave the company the telephone number of the people they want tabs on in foreign countries. AT&T then voluntarily supplied the agency with the information. This is just the latest in a series of recent revelations about the massive extent of spying on Americans and foreign citizens carried out by U.S. government agencies.
A lawsuit filed in New York has accused two major oil companies of price fixing and three banking firms of being involved in the illegal trades. BP and Shell stand accused of fixing crude oil prices from the North Sea. Lawyers representing the plaintiffs say this is essentially a case of insider trading, but critics of the lawsuit say that the prices set in these cases are just part of doing business in the oil industry. And the companies involved did not do anything illegal. The lawsuit is likely to be tried in a New York courtroom next month.
A new bill introduced by the U.S. Senate would close a loophole that allows corporations to claim the money they pay in fines as a tax write-off. The Government Settlement Transparency and Reform Act would stop the current practice in which corporations can reap tax benefits when making payments to settle allegations of violating regulations. The bill was introduced by U.S. Senators Jack Reed and Charles Grassley. Under current law, if corporations reach a settlement with the government over penalties for regulatory violations, part of that settlement can be written off as a tax deduction. The penalty paid is treated by companies as the cost of doing business. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Amit Narang of Public Citizen.
Talk about the introduction of the Government Settlement Transparency and Reform Act. What is that act and what will it do?
Sure. So this is big news and welcome news for those that really believe in strong enforcement of illegal corporate behavior. Right now, what happens when the government and corporations, large organizations that violate the law or certain regulations, what happens is they are required to pay often large sums of money in settlements, but a significant chunk of which is deductible as a tax deduction currently. And the way that corporations are allowed to deduct these settlement payments from the from their taxes is simply because currently if the government doesn't specifically indicate in the settlement agreement that the corporation is paying a penalty, and they have to specifically say penalty, not just fine, that for tax purposes is treated as a business expense for the corporation. And so what's been the case quite often...
How is that possible? I mean, if a citizen gets a parking ticket, they can't deduct that from their taxes. How do corporations have this type of loophole?
Well, I mean, it is pretty outrageous. Essentially, if the, the problem here is that the tax code treats business expenses as deductible, and settlements are... right now considered to be business expenses unless they're specifically categorized as penalties. Now, the problem is that corporations are often savvy enough to negotiate with government regulators and government lawyers to make sure that the settlement fine that they're paying is not categorized as a penalty, knowing full well that they'll get a big tax break out of it and that taxpayers will be subsidizing their bad behavior. I mean, it really is an instance in which, these fines that corporations pay when they violate the law and often in very egregious fashions.
And I understand that J.P. Morgan's settlement was one of the things that spurred this bill. Can you talk about that settlement?
Sure. So J.P. Morgan just entered into what looks on at first blush to be a pretty significant settlement agreement and a pretty significant fine. They were asked to pay $13 billion to cover the violations essentially that occurred when mortgage homeowners were essentially defrauded of quite a bit of their money, and also you know, lied to by mortgage servicers on the status of their home loans and their debt. Now, $13 billion sounds like a lot of money, but the news is that J.P. Morgan is really only going to be responsible for a fraction of that.
Thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Amit Narang. He is the regulatory policy advocate at Public Citizen. Their website, citizen.org, speaking about the introduction of the Government Settlement Transparency and Reform Act, S-1654, in the U.S. Senate, introduced by Senators Reid and Grassley. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In a historic vote today, the Senate passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, outlawing workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The 64-32 vote gave the landmark civil rights legislation the majority it needed to advance to the House. Along with every Senate Democrat, 10 Republican senators joined in to advance the ENDA. Along with the main vote on the act, senators rejected by 12 votes an amendment introduced by Republican Senator Toomey to expand religious exemption to the act. While the House passed a version of the act in 2007 that did not include protections for transgender people, this is the first time it's been passed in the Senate. The ENDA was first introduced in the mid-90s by Senator Ted Kennedy, who passed leadership down to Oregon's Senator Jeff Merkley, who has fought for the bill in its present stage. Here is Mr. Merkley speaking this week in support of ENDA passage on the Senate floor.
So the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which ends discrimination against our LGBT community, is rooted in the best of American values. It's rooted in the concepts of liberty and freedom in our founding documents and our founding vision. It's rooted in the concept of fundamental fairness. How unfair is it if an individual who is seeking to apply to a job cannot have a full opportunity for that job, a full opportunity to thrive because of discrimination? How fair is it, because of who you are outside of the workplace, that you are fired from the workplace? Let us think of the golden rule. We all learned this early in life, that we should treat others according to how we would want to be treated. And we would all want to be treated with respect and dignity that President Johnson referred to. It is a vision of equality that was in the Declaration of Independence, and it's the vision of opportunity that's rooted so deeply in the American dream. The idea that in America, if you work and study hard, you can do just about anything. No, that's a vision my father gave to me when he took me to the schoolhouse doors when I was small, and he said, if you go through those doors and you study hard here in America, you can do just about anything. But discrimination takes away from that vision of opportunity. It says, if you study hard here in America, you can do just about anything unless you have a certain color of skin, unless you have a certain gender, unless you have a certain gender identity or sexual orientation. Now, we've struck down many of those barriers. We've advanced on this vision of equality, but we have further to go. That's what this debate is about. In 29 states, you can still be fired from the job. You can still be told not to apply in the beginning because of your sexual orientation or your gender identity. In 29 states. It should not be the case that the vision of equality and fairness and opportunity happens to occur on one side of a state line, but it's destroyed if you cross that state line. Because this vision of opportunity and fairness and equality that's in our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence didn't say that this vision is only if you live in particular states, only if you live in the 21 states that have protections for our lesbian, gay, and bisexual community, or only if you live in the 17 states that have protections of employment for our transgender community.
That was Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley addressing the Senate this week ahead of today's vote to advance the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Oregon is one of 21 states with state legislation barring LGBT workplace discrimination. Oregon approved the act in the year 2007.
The U.S. Labor Department is proposing that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, begin requiring companies to submit workplace injury and illness reports electronically so that they can eventually be displayed online. OSHA says that the measure is in line with President Obama's pledge to make the government more transparent. Companies with more than 250 employees would submit their data quarterly, and companies in industries with high rates of injury with more than 20 employees would submit a summary of injury data yearly. David Michaels, the head of OSHA, says that these changes would provide the agency with better access to injury data, as well as workers, researchers, and the public at large, though they have not specified how quickly the data would be made public. He says that public display would encourage companies to focus more on accident prevention. Business interests, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, say the reports would not reflect the context in which accidents occur and would be intrusive. Currently, companies are required to post a summary of workplace injuries and illnesses yearly in a common area where it can be seen by employees and to submit the numbers to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, though the name of the company is not publicly displayed.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Tougher gun laws is one reason being cited for the Democratic victories in Virginia on Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
There are a number of reasons being cited for Democrat Terry McAuliffe's victory over his Republican challenger Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia's gubernatorial race on Tuesday, and polls show guns as being a leading factor. Tom Jensen is director at Public Policy Polling.
26% of Republican voters in Virginia said they were less likely to vote for Cuccinelli because of his stance on background checks. So that was definitely one of the issues that was causing some people who tend to vote for the GOP to really have some doubts about whether Cuccinelli was an appropriate governor.
Americans for Responsible Solutions Executive Director Pia Corazon said Virginia shows that gun extremism is no longer a winning position in the United States.
Gun extremism is not a winning message in this country anymore, and including in states like Virginia, south of the Mason-Dixon line, that have a history of gun ownership, the way Arizona and other states do.
Gerardo Hernandez, the TSA officer shot to death at LAX last Friday, was a member of the American Federation of Government Employees Union. A memorial fund has been established by the family, and the union is supportive of that effort. David Bohr is AFGE's general counsel. He says the union wants to see armed federal law enforcement officers stationed at airport TSA checkpoints, but doesn't want TSA officers themselves to be armed.
What we've proposed is that TSA adopt a force of trained law enforcement officers in uniform with weapons stationed at every checkpoint to protect our officers and the traveling public.
The LAX shooter was intensely anti-government, and Bohr says that right-wing government-hating political rhetoric is an important factor in this tragedy.
The right-wing media and certain members of Congress have absolutely demonized TSA since the day it started, and they talk constantly about our officers as if they're the enemy. And that kind of rhetoric You don't shout fire in a crowded theater. Well, these officers are not the enemy. And that kind of rhetoric now, the people who have been saying those things need to own a piece of what happened on Friday.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News will leave the air November 15th unless a significant amount of emergency money is raised very quickly. We're fighting hard to make sure WIN stays on the air. Go to laborradio.org and hit the donate button to pay your labor news dues. Listener support will help us stay on the air. Laborradio.org and click the donate button now. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fresh Pentagon reports on sexual assault in the military reveal a 46% rise in reported cases in the past fiscal year from the same time period last year. From October 2012 to June 2013, over 3,500 cases of military sexual assault, defined therein as rape, sodomy, or unwanted sexual contact, were reported to the Department of Defense. In contrast to the Pentagon's figures of reported cases in 2012, a survey amongst over 1 million active service members found a far higher number of 26,000 cases of sexual assault in the previous year. Now, a pair of congressional hearings are underway to address the issue of sex crimes in the military. For more information on the sexual assault epidemic, FSN's Alice Olstein filed this report from Washington.
Ariana Clay served for many years in the U.S. Marines, at the barracks in D.C., and in combat in Iraq. During her service, she was sexually assaulted by fellow servicemen. Speaking before senators this week, she said both military's current rules and her commander in particular created a toxic and permissive atmosphere in her unit.
My commander did have the power to deny the presence of harassment. His authority gave him ownership of the truth, yet without accountability. He decided, in writing, that calling officers sluts and whores was not harassment, and that any harassment was deserved because of what I wore or that I'd complained about it. It was the retaliation and condoning of harassment that I believe made those who harmed me feel protected and encouraged.
When her case finally went to trial, she was put through what she described as 15 hours of degrading testimony. She called on the gathered lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, to pass a bill to take the decision to prosecute outside the chain of command.
It is impossible to expect justice in a legal system run primarily by commanders with no legitimate legal training, who have a vested interest in the outcome of their proceedings and an undeniable favoritisms that are only human nature.
Following a report last year that found that the majority of sexual assaults in the military are never reported, and the vast majority of those reported are never brought to justice, many lawmakers have been calling for legal changes. Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill introduced a bill to strip commanders of the ability to overturn jury verdicts for those convicted of sexual assault. New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand wants to go even further by moving the decision to prosecute outside the chain of command.
Until you have an objective review by a trained military prosecutor who does not have any biases for or against the perpetrator or the victim, will you see justice being done?
Pentagon leaders have come out in strong opposition to Gillibrand's Military Justice Improvement Act, claiming it would, quote, undercut the good order and discipline of the military. Some members of Congress are also opposed, and a filibuster is expected if and when it makes it to the Senate floor. But Gillibrand says her reforms are necessary because the current system is inherently unjust.
If a commander prefers the perpetrator, or the perpetrator is well-liked, or very popular, or more valuable to the unit, that case will not be pushed forward. That is a serious breach of trust and a serious breach in the ability of justice being done within our military.
Another bill introduced this week by California Democrat Barbara Boxer tackles another area of the military justice system, so-called Article 32 hearings, which are used to decide whether there's enough evidence to take a case to a court-martial. Boxer is seeking to exempt victims of sexual assault from having to testify at these hearings, which are open to the public and the press, and limit the kinds of questions lawyers can ask if they choose to take the stand.
At the Article 32 your rapist will be sitting there and you'll have to relive and retell everything that's happened to you. So it's very intimidating.
That's Miranda Peterson with the advocacy group Protect Our Defenders. She says one hearing at the U.S. Naval Academy this summer proves a clear example of why so few sexual assaults are reported in the military. In that case, a 21-year-old woman who reported being sexually assaulted at a party by three Naval Academy football players was aggressively cross-examined for days by military lawyers. Though the presiding judge barred defense attorneys from asking whether she carried condoms in her purse, they were allowed to ask whether she was wearing a bra or underwear at the time of the assault, whether she lies, quote, at least once a day, and how wide she opens her mouth to perform oral sex.
It's traumatic, it's unnecessary, and we think that making this voluntary, allowing them to submit a statement instead, will make them feel more comfortable with the system, will increase the likelihood that they continue to cooperate, which is crucial to prosecuting these crimes successfully.
Senators will attempt to attach all these proposed reforms as amendments to the National Defense Authorization Act, which Congress will begin debating in the weeks leading up to their Thanksgiving break. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
During the darkness before dawn in Athens, Greece, riot police conducted a raid, ending the five-month sit-in by journalists who had lost their jobs due to the closure of a television station. The Greek government, in June of this year, took the legendary Hellenic Broadcasting Network, or ERT, off the air in order to meet austerity measures. This caused the firing of over 2,000 people. ERT workers have continued to keep illegal news feeds on the air using British equipment. The police fired some tear gas into the area where dozens of unemployed journalists have been occupying the station since its closure. Hundreds of Greek citizens and supporters of the fired employees turned out to protest the raid, even as it was happening.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, seven Afghan civilians believed to have been kidnapped by the Taliban earlier this year were found dead yesterday in southern Zabul province, apparently tortured. It is believed that the Taliban was punishing them for their perceived roles in helping the Afghan security forces, which underscores the danger to civilians involved with the national military as international forces withdraw. Also, a roadside bomb in Eastern Coast Province killed five Afghan intelligence operatives with the National Directorate of Security, or NDS, today. Meanwhile, the NDS foiled a suicide bomb plot against a senior government official in the capital of Kabul.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, November 7th, 2013. Israeli soldiers kidnap internet activists from Jerusalem and settlers attack villagers in southern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers and police officers kidnapped on Wednesday evening and Thursday at dawn 25 young Palestinian men and women active in social network sites exposing Israeli violations. Head of the Jerusalem office of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, Nasser Kous, said that the soldiers invaded large numbers of internet coffee shops and computer stores in the occupied city, searched them and kidnapped the 25 Palestinians. Al-Kous added that seven young women were among those kidnapped and that the soldiers released 15 of the kidnapped later on. The police in the occupied city claimed that the kidnapped Palestinians conducted incitement against the army. Also on Thursday at dawn, Israeli sources have reported that rounds of live ammunition were fired at an Israeli military vehicle near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, causing no injuries. The sources claim that the car drove out of Na'lin village near Ramallah and its passengers opened fire at Israeli military jeep before fleeing the scene. The army said that soldiers fired back at the vehicle and chased it into the village. The army added that the soldiers invaded Na'lin. Another vehicle tried to ram an Israeli officer who fired at the car before it fled the scene. Elsewhere, Israeli settlers attacked on Thursday Palestinian residents from the village of Beni Noaim, east of Hebron City, southern West Bank. According to residents, a group of settlers invaded the village and set two cars on fire and also wrote racist graffiti threatening to kill the residents.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kristen Yount and Sam Bowman. The producer is myself, Jen Chavez. Special thanks to KBOO's Air Cascadia host, Chris Andre, and thanks also to reporters with LaborRadio.org and FSN. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland, guest host, Positively Revolting Talk Radio. He'll speak with nuclear expert Arnold Gunderson about fuel rod removal, radiation releases, and other issues related to what's happening at the Fukushima nuclear facility. At 9, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Portlanders Tammy Dean and Hossein Rajantalab, who recently returned from 7 months traveling in Iran, which is Hossein's country of origin. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 a.m. on the Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemen interviews author and editor-in-chief of The Economist website, Tom Standage. They discuss his most recent book, Writing on the Wall, a historical look at social media, the first 2,000 years. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed the drive, you can still donate by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview with Tracy Prescott McGregor about her fight against a coal export terminal expansion in Clatskanie, Oregon.
With my wife, Tracy, I have a small farm within a mile of the proposed rezoning. We have goats, some chickens, some turkeys, and a garden. And we are simply trying to raise as much of our own food in a sustainable manner as we can. We love this land and are strongly opposed to the rezoning. Our farm borders the Columbia River, which for more than a million years has carried a considerable portion of the rain that falls in the Pacific Northwest out to the ocean. For the last 10,000 years, human beings have lived as a part of the rich ecosystem that has flourished in this area. I am descended from some of the Native Americans who have learned to live in harmony with the salmon and the eagle. I've been raised to understand that we are just a small part of this intricate web of life. We share this world with many other creatures, beaver, osprey, and even coyote, with whom I sometimes share my poultry. And we must respect their right to live here. And like all the other creatures, take only what we need. For the last few hundred years, this river has been turned to human uses on a scale never seen before and at great expense to the habitat. Fueled by an apparently unbounded desire for more, our dams, our pollution, our commerce, are choking the life out of the river. There are consequences for the entire planet. What we are considering here tonight is less than 1,000 acres of land and just a few miles of river shore. But every step backward makes the journey longer. And with every acre that is paved, and industrialized, the river and the habitat are further degraded. I am an elder of the Jamestown Sklallams, and we have a teaching that one's actions and the consequences of those actions must be considered to the seventh generation. That is a very difficult concept to apply. But even the third generation, your own grandchildren, will see this project as a scheme that will enrich a few in the short term to the long-term detriment of many. This does not have to happen. You have the opportunity to make a better choice.
That was Scott McGregor testifying at a recent hearing against a proposal to expand Port Westward in Klatskanai, Oregon. Joining us this evening is Scott's wife, Tracy Prescott McGregor. The two of them have been leading a struggle to stop the rezoning of nearly 1,000 acres of prime agricultural land to rural industrial. Thank you for joining us, Tracy.
Thank you.
So, Tracy, first off, can you talk a little bit about your farm and where it's located?
Well, we're located on Erickson Dyke Road, which is a dike that along the Columbia River here in Klatskanai, and we have 6 acres. And we are trying to grow as much of our own food as we can.
And how is this rezoning that's being discussed going to impact your farm?
Well, there will be increased traffic, rail traffic. There will be potential pollution hazards that haven't been adequately addressed, and that's mostly the issues that we're struggling with.
And yes, you mentioned part of the issue in the port expansion is that it will bring with it train loads of coal and oil for export. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of these coal and oil trains in detail?
Well, the oil trains, unfortunately, they are already coming through here. An ethanol plant was built to export ethanol, and it went out of business. And when it did, they converted it into a crude oil terminal. So now they're already bringing in crude oil from North Dakota to be barged out to the coast of Washington, Anacortes, Washington, to be refined. So that's already going on. It's not clear whether these train tanks were built for carrying this crude, so it's a little bit iffy there. So there's a lot of concern for that. Also, if this does become as big an energy hub as they're talking about, there will be many, many more trains, and there is possibly coal on the table, which would carry with it dust issues that could create pollution all the way along the train lines from Montana, where it's being mined, through all the communities and out into any kind of drainage or water. And the coal contains arsenic and lead and a host of other things that we probably don't want to be eating in our food.
And the various pollution concerns that you're discussing, what will the impact of those be on the Columbia River?
Well, barging oil is seems pretty dangerous to me, especially if you're going out into the ocean. The possibility of any kind of leak or accident, and it would affect the whole, all the shoreline on the river, all the animals, the wildlife, the habitat along the coast. And as far as coal goes, there's all kinds of possibilities that it's going to be shipped to Asia, and then it's going to be burned there, and then chances are that it'll even come back on the jet stream to repollute us again.
I see, and I understand that the county Planning Commission actually recommended against the rezoning application that might carry all the harmful effects that you're talking about. How is it that the rezoning is still on the table in light of that?
I wonder that myself. The Port of St. Helens didn't follow their recommendation. The Columbia County Planning Commission voted 5-1 against, you know, recommending against this rezone because they wanted to protect the farmlands. And the Port of St. Helens went ahead and resubmitted the application, and now the Columbia County Commissioners are scheduled to mid-month make a decision on whether to allow this rezoning.
Oh, that's coming up very soon. So specifically speaking to you, you and your husband are farmers. The port's proposal would eliminate over 600 acres of productive farmland. Those who would lose their land are your neighbors. Do you know how they feel about the proposal?
Well, Mike Seeley, who is a mint farmer out here, would it would devastate his business. He would have to relocate. Mint is very susceptible to dust, and also the trains coming through would disrupt a lot of the farmers' ability to get back and forth and move their machines and things like that to get, you know, to do their work, cultivate their crops.
And those of you that have, you know, spoken out in opposition to this rezoning, what kind of support have you seen from the regional coalition to stop coal export terminals across the region?
Well, we've had a lot of support. The Riverkeepers have been, Columbia Riverkeeper has been wonderful. And they have posted our petition, and we're going to present that petition to the commissioners right before their meeting on November 13th. Their meeting is at 10 a.m. in the morning, and we're going to try to be there to give the petition, and we're hoping to get 1,000 signatures.
Yeah, and I wanted to just ask a little bit more details about the petition. What is your petition asking for, and as you hope to reach 100,000 signatures, what's the progress at this point?
Oh, it's 1,000. I'd love to have 100,000.
I'm sorry. 1,000 signatures. Yes, 100,000 would be a whole different story.
Yes. Well, we're trying to ask the Columbia County Commissioners to say no to this application. Just say no. There already is land on the port westward that is designated to be developed for industrial, and it hasn't even been used yet, and now they're asking to add another 957 acres, which includes 600 acres of prime farmland. And the soils are beautiful out here. They're excellent for growing crops and food. And once that's paved over, it's never going to be available again for growing food.
And in the event that the Columbia County Board of Commissioners does approve this rezoning, what are further steps that can be taken to oppose this these changes?
Well, there's a little bit of there's a Senate bill called 766, which expedites permitting, and that would allow the port to go through the process of permitting for building on this newly rezoned land very quickly. And the hope is that it would actually go to the Land Use Board of Appeals, and then they could look at all the testimony that's been given so far in hopes that they would then reject it. But we're not sure how that's all going to work out. It's a big question.
And the meeting that's coming up mid-month, I understand that is a public meeting of the Columbia County Board of Commissioners. Is there going to be any time at this meeting for public comment? Or if not, how can the public at least access this meeting?
Well, the meeting will be at Columbia County Courthouse at 10 o'clock. That's at 230 Strand Street in St. Helens, Oregon. there probably will be no public comment at this time. The time for public comment has been closed.
I see.
There's nothing to stop us from presenting them with this petition, which we're hoping that will convince them that there are enough people out there that do not want this zoning change and that they should say no to the port's application.
Absolutely, and I just wanted to let our listeners know there is a link to that petition on ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org as well, in case anyone is interested in checking that out. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the air this evening. We've been speaking with... Yes, you're welcome. We've been speaking with Tracy Prescott McGregor, who, along with her husband, has been leading a struggle to stop the rezoning of nearly 1,000 acres of agricultural land to expand a port in Clatskanie, Oregon. Thank you again so much for joining us.
All righty. Thank you. Take care.
You too. And coming up next is Wisdom of the Elders.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
The KBOO Foundation, licensee of non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yeaman. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Close Guantanamo, a public forum featuring the past president of Veterans for Peace, Elliot Adams, plus Portland's Guantanamo Solidarity Vigilers. Close Guantanamo is co-sponsored by VFP Chapter 72 and the Economic Justice Action and Peace Action Groups of the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Adams will discuss different messages about why we will be better off when Guantanamo is closed from various perspectives: Christian, Muslim, Jewish, those concerned about national security, and the fiscally minded. Close Guantanamo will be at the Elliott Chapel, First Unitarian Church of Portland, on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue on November 7th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders, featuring the stories and songs